Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The numbers don't lie. The nation as a whole has regained about 85% of the jobs lost during the recession. Ohio has replaced about half of the roughly 414,000 jobs lost during that period. Economist Bill Lafayette told the Columbus Metropolitan Club in early January that the key to adding jobs and population to the Buckeye State is for workers to improve their skills. That means more education. But is it that simple? Coming up, we'll hear some points of view on the topic about what attracts and or grows jobs. Joining us now to parse the numbers behind the unemployment and job creation rates, what those terms mean and how they are figured, is Doug Buchanan, managing editor of Columbus Business First. Welcome back, Doug.
Thank you.
So we had an uptick in the number of jobs in December, but Ohio still lags the nation in job growth at 0.5% compared to 1.6%, which seems like such small numbers, but still, nationally, it's three times what it is in the state.
Right. And in the aggregate, as you pointed out, since the recession, Columbus has gotten all their jobs back. The United States is most of the way back, and Ohio is well back from a lot of other places, with only about half of those 400,000 jobs lost. So clearly the state as a whole is lagging still.
And the state's unemployment rate fell slightly to 7.2%, but it's still trailing the national rate of 6.7%.
Right.
Are these just different sides of the same coin, or do they tell different stories about the job situation in Ohio?
Well, and it is interesting because over the year we did add jobs, but we also had more unemployed. And so you get into one of those deals where, you know, kind of getting into the weeds of how they do this. There are two different surveys, one of employers, one of households. And of course, as we've discussed before, when you have discouraged workers who start working again, they are officially part of the labor force again and are counted. And if they can't find a job, then that hurts the unemployment rate. You know, I think the larger point here is that as you pointed out, we started out the year better than the U.S. And over the course of this year, the U.S. got better, Ohio got worse. And so we've switched sides now, and Ohio has a worse unemployment rate than the U.S. And obviously 2014, that's going to be a major challenge for us to get that turned back around.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Doug Buchanan of the Columbus Business First. We're talking about jobs, job creation this hour. Ohio is lagging the rest of the country, or at least the nation as a whole. Columbus is doing okay, but the rest of the state, not so good. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Doug Buchanan, how do we define jobs? So when we talk about, say, the 414,000 jobs that still have, you know, that Ohio hasn't replaced yet,
right,
from the recession, is that really 414 full-time jobs, that kind of a thing, the living wage type jobs, or what do we mean by that?
Well, it can be full-time jobs, full-time equivalent jobs, and again, when you're talking about the labor force, you're talking about anybody looking for a job, people who had part-time jobs. I mean, it's the whole gamut, but the overriding point is that for Ohioans who simply want to work, if you actually add in that number of discouraged workers, that number of jobs that we have lost is actually much higher, because we had a labor market participation rate that was higher back when the economy was booming. And so, even if you only watch the unemployment rate, there's still another gap there of Ohioans who are not working and are, you know, basically a drag on the economy because they aren't even going out there and looking for work yet. Yes, that 400,000 jobs is a big number, we have a lot more work than even that appears to get the economy back to, you know, what we consider to be full steam.
So at the outset of the recession, there were about 840,000 or 850,000 jobs lost. They're saying half been replaced.
Yeah, half of them have been replaced. In Ohio, but I think to the point of what we're talking about today is the actual makeup of that,
right,
of that jobs has changed significantly. We've lost an incredible number of manufacturing jobs, and that industry, even though it's it has bounced back in certain segments of it, overall, that's not where the significant parts of our growth is coming from. For that, you've got to go healthcare, you've got to go IT, logistics, those sorts of things, and manufacturing to a certain extent. I mean, I'm not saying it's still shrinking, but to take all of those workers who lost manufacturing jobs and to get them the right skills to be able to go into these other sectors, that's going to be, it's a continuing challenge for the state.
Do you think as a state mentally, and this is a kind of a squishy question, but okay. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about it. As a state mentally, are we still looking for those manufacturing jobs? Are people still waiting for those factories to reopen? Or are we retooling for something new, and are people waiting for the announcement of the next IT firm that's bringing jobs?
I think for sure there's a significant part of the population that wants those manufacturing jobs to come back, and even for the people of Jobs Ohio and those sorts. I mean, they're obviously looking for those big manufacturing plants because you're talking about hundreds of very well paying jobs if they can get them. So there is still that desire to have that come back. And it's been 5 years since we've started the recovery. And I don't know on an individual basis how long you have to be jobless before you finally decide that you're going to turn around and try something new. But again, that's part of what the state, the challenge is to show people that they do have the opportunities and they do have the chance to get that retraining. And if that message isn't getting out there, then we're going to continue to just float along.
Arizona State University researchers ranked Ohio 46th nationally in job creation in 2013. The ASU rankings didn't put Ohio above 41st for the entire year. That was just in the 1 month of November was the 46th ranking. How are such rankings, or are they not helpful?
Well, I mean, you could look at them as helpful as a call to action. The Federal Reserve did another one where they looked at four different kinds of indicators of the job market. And in November and December, we were one of, I think, only three states that went backwards. The rest of the country was making progress. And, both on wages and job creation, Ohio and Alaska and I think one state somewhere in the South actually regressed. And so, I think this is kind of what we're going to talk about here in the next segment. If you talk about what do we need to do to turn that around, I think you can look at that and say, well, perhaps maybe what we have been doing isn't working.
Here's a quick question from James in Columbus. Hi, James. You're on the air with Doug Buchanan of Columbus Business First.
Oh, thank you. Yes. My question is about, I am employed. I have four part-time on-call jobs. I've been unable to find a full-time position with benefits since about 2010. And I wonder how the government classifies people like me. Is that counted as full employment, or I don't understand?
Is that like a full-time equivalent type? I'm asking Doug Buchanan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
It would depend on the number of hours, I believe, he serves, but I don't think it certainly wouldn't count as four jobs. I think that they would accumulate those. It may count as, I'm not mm-hmm. sure exactly, but, we do have a lot of those types of situations in the state. So, they are counted in some way. The point that I think in what he would try to say is that, if you can get that, true full-time job instead of a series of part-time jobs, that's going to be far better for the state as a whole. And I think that's what the job creators, the economic development officials in the state are working for.
Because even if you could patch together four jobs, part-time jobs, it'll get you to the income level you were at.
Right.
You don't get the benefits.
Yeah. Right. So there's not the buying power. There's not the stability. There's not the hope that things are getting better.
James, thanks a lot for that call. The Kasich administration routinely cites job growth from 2011 and early 2012 as evidence that his policies of tax cuts and the creation of his Jobs Ohio agency are working. Relatively speaking, though, did the rest of the nation recover at about the same pace during that period, or is that what you were talking about, where Ohio was marching along at the same rate and then fell back?
Right. We were marching along at the same rate. We were doing pretty well the first couple years of it, but it's just been over the past year that especially the second half of the year that we started falling behind again. And so I don't know if you can, you know, take that period of time and say that Jobs Ohio, you know, isn't working when, you know, if you looked at the 6 months, you know, the previous year, they were doing fine. So, you know, I think that they have a longer term plan, and certainly Columbus 2020, the local equivalent, obviously has a plan that's got another 6 years to go, and that's what they want to be judged on. And so, you know, I think taking any 6 month period is probably not that useful.
The current 2-year budget that took effect July 1st included a $2.7 billion net tax cut for individuals and small businesses over 3 years and a sales tax hike of a quarter cent per dollar, bringing the state share of the sales tax to $5.75 or 5.75%. And the governor is expected to ask for another income tax cut in the next few weeks. Are those kinds of tax cuts the ones that attract businesses, or are we talking about something different?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's the kind of, I think what their argument is, it's the kind of tax cuts that attract small businesses to, you know, if you put more, the idea is to put more money in the pockets of small businesses, then they'll add jobs. And I think what we've increasingly seen in Ohio and elsewhere is that hoping for a big manufacturing plant that employs 2,000 workers to suddenly move to Ohio is not realistic. You have to, the analogy I heard was more of a gardening approach, where you have to seed through incubators and through tax cuts of for small businesses, seed these smaller enterprises and hope that they turn into big employers. And I think you know, any step that you can take to encourage those smaller enterprises, that's what the, you know, that's what state officials want to do.
So the tax cut for smaller businesses the idea is to encourage more people to start small businesses. The tax burden isn't what it was now. It's
correct.
Easier to get into it. It's not necessarily for existing small businesses.
Well, no, it is. I mean, if you are a small business owner and you have more money in your pocket, if you're more profitable, then you are more likely to turn around and hire somebody, you know, as you grow, because you have that money to spend on another employee. But, you know, that's one component
of
a
theory.
Yes. And we're talking about in theory. But again, you know, that's one component of a large spectrum of reasons why small businesses would hire and wouldn't hire. You know, I think you know, Dale probably has some opinions on whether that you know, whether that works longer term.
We will bring in Dale Butland of Innovation Ohio, and also Richard Vetter, economist, retired from Ohio University and now with the Center for College Affordability and Productivity, when we return. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about jobs in Ohio, or the lack thereof, if you're watching national rankings like the one from Arizona State University that puts Ohio at 46th in the nation in job creation, or the rate of unemployment, 7.2% compared to the national rate of 6.7%. Still with us is Doug Buchanan, managing editor of Columbus Business First. Joining us now by phone from Ohio University in Athens is economist Richard Vetter, retired from OU and now director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be with you, Ann.
Also joining us in the studio is Dale Butland, communications director for Innovation Ohio, a Columbus-based think tank. Welcome back to the show, Dale.
Hi, Ann. Good morning.
We were talking about tax cuts. We're going to get to education, but before we do any of that, I wanted to hear from both of you about how is it more accurate to describe our jobs economy through unemployment figures or through job creation? A lot, we talk about job creation a lot. What do you think, Dale?
Well, I think both. And the sad fact is we're trailing the national average in both. As was just mentioned in the last segment, our job creation rate is there are only four states in the country worse than we are right now. And for the first time in 3 years, our unemployment rate is higher than the national average. So we're trailing on both scores.
Richard Vedder?
Well, I think the single most, the statistic I like to look at the most is something called the employment population ratio. That's the percentage of adults who are working. A low ratio would reflect high unemployment, but it would also reflect other things. The Ohio rate by that measure is, we're a little bit above the national average, nothing to brag about because the national average is very low, a little over 58 out of every 100 Americans, or for that matter, 58 out of every 100 adult Ohioans are actually working. It's 0.1% higher in Ohio than in the nation. By either measure, the nation has got a long ways to go to having a full recovery.
Neither of those statistics usually tell us what job was lost or gained. Data on unemployment, for example, tells us nothing about the kinds of jobs available in the workplace or the terms by which workers hold them, such as whether they're permanent or temporary or full-time as opposed to part-time. If we want to turn those numbers around, Richard Vedder, how do we do that without knowing what we've lost?
Well, you raised a good point. We sort of assume with the statistics that we treat employment like pregnancy. You either are or you're not. The reality is employment has many different degrees to it, and both in terms of the number of hours worked, that is the work effort, and also with respect to the productivity of the job or its worth, both to the worker and to society. And so you have to look at the quality of job. Unfortunately, most of the statistics that are reported do not allow us to do that very well. And that is a deficiency. The last numbers I saw on December employment for Ohio actually showed Ohio gaining 14,000 jobs. But I don't know whether those jobs were working at $7.25 an hour in fast food places or they were paying $100,000 a year in high-level technical work.
But here's what we do know, Dale, though, Ann, and I know that Dr. Vedder would back this up. Something like 72% of all the new jobs created since the recovery began have been low-wage jobs. So the possibility or the probability that these are high-wage jobs that have been created is pretty small. And in fact, in the state of Ohio, I think we've seen surveys and polling data indicating that if people are lucky enough to have a job now, oftentimes they say it pays less than the one they lost during the recession.
Doug Buchanan, when we talk about job creation, when the governor's talking about it, when anyone's talking about it, are we talking about good jobs?
Oh, yeah.
Or any old job?
Certainly any old job is going to do, but nobody is going to brag about creating jobs at 7-Eleven or Taco Bell. I mean, you're talking about jobs like this Fuyao glass plant, the Chinese manufacturer that's the auto part supplier that's coming to Dayton. That's the kind of jobs we're talking about that are going to make headlines and the politicians are going to brag about. Kind of getting back to that question, if you look at the projections for industries that are hiring. Obviously, there's a lot of healthcare workers on there, but even within healthcare, if you're talking about healthcare home aides, not so much. If you're talking about technicians, then the jobs are higher. So even within the industries that we know are growing, you can still get this gradation where it's entirely possible to get a job that doesn't pay maybe what you used to make in a manufacturing plant.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about jobs and the economy and what it takes to grow them or create them. Dr. Vedder, you've written about why recent college graduates are underemployed. Is there a connection between that trend and states like Ohio falling behind in job creation?
Well, I don't. I think that obviously education matters to individuals who are looking for jobs. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Mm-hmm. College graduates, for example, have lower unemployment rates than high school graduates. That's indisputable. But if you did, I did in preparation for this show, I actually did a little statistical analysis for the fun of it, looking at college, the percentage of people in each state that have college degrees, and I related that to the unemployment rates in recent months, data that's easily available. And there was no statistically significant relationship between the two at all. One problem that happens is that if you in some states that where you have a large percentage of college graduates, you're getting more and more college graduates sort of crowding out high school graduates who previously would be the baristas at the local cafe, coffee shop, and so forth. And they're being crowded out by the college grads who are taking over the jobs that high school grads used to hold.
Are we teaching people the wrong skills for the jobs that are out there then?
Well, I think there's a problem there. I do think, and you can blame partially the colleges, you can blame partially the students for the subjects that they choose, but there is not a strong there are problems in that unemployment and low-wage jobs are much more prevalent among graduates in some disciplines than in others in college. There's no question about that. You look at the data. There's a data problem, but to the extent we have good data, we know, for example, that people in the engineering fields and accounting and some majors like that do far, far better after graduation than those, say, majoring in social work, anthropology, or subjects of that nature.
Robin, in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Robin.
Good morning, Ohio, as they would say in Japanese. my question, or my statement, I should say, is that one of the things that I really regret doing and not doing in high school is going to Eastland Vocational School, because I tend to see that people with vocational trades, especially something like HVAC or a trade that's going to tend to be beneficial for our society's infrastructure, I seem to see these people more employed than even some college graduates. Even some of the officers I served with in the military weren't as smart as they thought they were. So what's your idea on, you know, basically getting people into a trade before they even graduate high school, sir?
Well, as the owner of a brand new heating and air conditioning system, I hear what you're talking about, Robin. Dr. Vetter?
Well, you know, I think the caller has a point. There was a time a generation or two ago when it was considered honorable and good for students to go to vocational high schools and then to vocational type schools, career colleges and so forth after high school, and that was considered honorable. But in the last 25 years or so, we've sort of created the image that people that don't go to a traditional four-year college are somehow missing out on something in life, that they're sort of a lower economic form of humanity, and there's a stigma attached to that. And we do need more plumbers and HVAC, and we need more welders and so on. And we are turning now. We have 115,000 janitors with bachelor's degrees now in the United States because they couldn't get jobs in the field that they were trained in college. So I think the caller has a point. You know, you can overdo that. There's a limit to the number of plumbers we need. But these are honorable professions, and there's nothing wrong with people pursuing them. And we perhaps denigrated the trades too much in this country.
Doug Buchanan?
Well, I think the old saw is that you know, these are jobs that can't be exported to China or India or whatever the next low-wage country is. You know that the opportunity will exist, in the state. So, there is a place for that. And again, if we're going back to this idea of the educated students that we're turning out, are they mismatched for the skills? Well, or if you're a current unemployed worker, the trade schools and the 2-year colleges, those are going to be the quickest, most efficient, most targeted ways to get into industries that are hiring, because these schools, that's why they create these specific programs, because they know that there's an end to that.
Yeah, I think we can all agree, we can corporately agree that there is a need for trade schools, there's a need for people who know these trades. My concern, though, is this. America is quickly becoming a low-wage country, even for these trades, even for attorneys in professional schools. You see where the wages are dropping. The problem has been is that In the years after World War II, up until roughly 1980, the increased productivity of the country, the fruits of that productivity, were shared throughout the workforce. So folks at the top got their share, but so did folks all the way through the middle. And that steadily expanding middle class allowed the rising standard of living that made this country the envy of all the world. But what's happened over the past number of years is that the fruits of that productivity are not being spread throughout the society, throughout the workforce, I should say, and are being concentrated at the very top. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a real problem.
I'm going to be talking to the co-author of a new book coming up in a little while, The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. And one of the themes in the book is that the spread and the bounty, the bounty and the spread of the bounty will be much different than what we've had over the last generation, over the first machine age.
Sure. Yeah, and you know, if you look at the manufacturing sector, it's high tech now. And so when we lost all those manufacturing jobs and the recession, even the manufacturing jobs that we have gained back are not the same manufacturing jobs that we had before. And you're either in that upper tier of workers there, or you're plainly just left behind.
Richard Vedder, the bootstrap idea, is it getting harder and harder in your
opinion? Well, I'm a little less pessimistic. Okay. In many ways, I'm more pessimistic than my colleagues on this conversation, in this conversation. But in one way, I'm less pessimistic. If you look at, I think the bottom line of work life is ultimately consumption. What is it that you, from what you earn, what are you able to buy, whether it be food and clothing or cruises or jet planes, it doesn't matter. What are you able to buy? And if you look at consumption spending among the American public over the last, say, 30, 40 years, until it is true there has been a fall off since the Great Recession in the last 5 years, but the general trend is it has risen. Now, has it risen equally for everyone? No, it hasn't. There's some people have gone ahead of others, and there is a widening income inequality. I don't deny that. But the notion that somehow that the poor being hugely exploited and that they're living, you know, on the, and not only the poor, the, say, the middle class living on sort of the brink of extinction, economic extinction, just doesn't fit reality. We're taking more cruises, we're buying more cell phones, we're doing more things with the fruits of what we do than we have ever before, or very close to the maximum. We may be a little below the peak, say 2007, but we're enjoying life like we never have before in this country, and I don't think we should lose sight of that. That is not to say that there aren't some other trends at work as well.
Well, I don't think a lot of regular people are taking that many more cruises, Professor Vedder, than they have in the past. I would also say that, you know, when you look, one of the reasons why we've had this great increase in the number of people, for example, having food stamps is because they're not earning wages that are living wages. People decry the fact that something like, 47% of the country now is getting some sort of assistance. But the truth is they're not getting paid enough to make it. We have instances, as you're well aware, of certain employers having applications for food stamps there along with the hiring papers. So in a sense, the taxpayers are really subsidizing many of these employers who are refusing to pay their workers a living wage.
Doug Buchanan, I wanted to get back briefly to the idea that that caller brought up about we should be training people in high school to do more things. Are we teaching people the wrong skills? If we were more efficient at placing students in job training beginning in high school, would Ohio be better off?
Well, I think certainly because, you know, one of the things that you're seeing is that the workforce readiness coming out of high school is not up to par in Ohio. So that is a larger question about, you know, academic standards. But, you know, clearly if we could train them for specific jobs, I don't know if you saw out in Columbiana County, they're going to start a charter school called the Utica Shale Academy, which they're going to specifically train workers to work in the oil and gas industry out there, which is
coming out of high school.
Coming out of high school, right? They're going to. I believe it's an online component to it, but clearly, that's right in the heart of the. Of the fracking play out in eastern Ohio, and if they can, get these workers trained to come out of high school to go right into these jobs that are clearly being created out there, then that's a good thing.
Dr. Vedder, what do you make of that? Do we spend enough time anymore, or are we just always pushing kids into college and not really sitting down and talking to them about what do you want to do and what are we capable of teaching you to do when you get out of high school?
I think there's a lot of misinformation out there or lack of information. There's probably been not enough good counseling going on. By the way, I'm not maligning guidance counselors. My wife is 35 years was one.
Okay.
And so I don't dare malign them, particularly if she's listening to the show. but they're busy people, and I think, different strokes for different folks. For some students, going on to a four-year college is the best option. They're bright. They're motivated. They're intellectually curious. They may want to go into the professions where a college degree is usually expected or maybe required. But there are other kids who, for whom academic work has always been something of a struggle or something not that it didn't interest them. They like to work with their hands, etc. And we don't discriminate enough. We should be tailoring people's educational training to their specific needs and their their abilities. But we don't do enough of that.
Well, a lot of that has to do with helping them understand what their abilities are.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And Doug Buchanan?
I will say, though, that if you look at the industries in Ohio that are projected to have the highest growth rates, the state actually breaks it down by the expected education level and the high school level. There's not nearly as many there as there are of the industries and job types that they want a two-year degree or even, they want a four-year degree. Those, the opportunities are far greater in those categories than simply having a high school degree. But, that may go back to Dr. Vedder's point about, having too many college graduates floating out there and kind of creating this this lift up there. But that's the case. Coming out of high school, your options are limited.
We are talking about jobs and how do you create them? Can you just create jobs, or does it have something more to do with the workforce and the tax structure, how we educate people? Give us a call if you have a question or comment for our panel, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about jobs. How do you get them and how do you get people ready for them? Richard Vedder is on the phone from Athens. He's an economist and director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. And also Doug Buchanan of Columbus Business First, where he's managing editor, and Dale Botlin, communications director of Innovation Ohio. We have lots of calls. I want to get to an email from a listener real quick. Brings up an interesting concept about Ohio. Writes, I understand why we want jobs for our current population, but I don't understand why it's a good idea to increase Ohio's population. The Ohio, Indiana, Illinois area is one of the absolute best areas for farming, not just in this country, but in the world. In terms of fertility and climate, wouldn't it be wiser to limit population growth and urban sprawl and concentrate on feeding the world? I speak as a guy who has had a long career working for an insurance company, so I've got no axe to grind here. Just seems to me we've long had wrong goals for Ohio. Richard, Dr. Vedder, what do you make of that?
Well, first of all, we don't have much population growth in Ohio.
it's supposedly desirable to have it.
Yeah. I'm agnostic on population. I mean, okay. I think I'm for population growth, I think. I don't agree with the caller. I mean, I'm not saying I disagree that we have some good farmland in the state, but I don't think one of the major problems in Ohio relates to population one way or the other. In fact, I think if we had greater population growth in the state, it would likely reflect in migration instead of out migration. The problem on the population front in the state of Ohio, and it's true of several other states as well, is that some of our best and brightest young people are leaving. And that's a concern. We lose good human capital to other states every year. And the natural population growth that comes from births exceeding deaths is partially, almost entirely offset by this out-migration and also the lack of immigration. We are one of the least immigrant-intensive states in the union, and I think in some cases that has had a negative, and to some respect, it's had a negative effect.
I was just going to echo something that he said. Is when you see the high population growth states, those are dynamic economies, and those are bringing people in. It's not as much to having to do with birth rates as it is to getting those best and brightest to want to come to Ohio and to move to Ohio and to find the good paying jobs and to create jobs here. So if we had better population growth, I think the economy would be better.
That's kind of the first thrust, though. Isn't a lot of the migration to people that come to do things for those people? The service economy that supports
it starts building on itself. Mm-hmm. You have to have the dynamic economy before you get the net immigration into the state. But still, once you kind of get that dynamic going, you'll see your population grow and the economy should grow right along with it.
And a lot of it, too, pertains to quality of life. Obviously, companies are not going to move to your state unless they believe that management, upper management's going to want to live there,
which
typically means a good education system, cultural opportunities, and so forth. I think Dr. Vetter made a very good point before when he talked about the brain drain. You know, right now, only 25% of kids who graduate from Ohio colleges stay here. Mm-hmm. 75% leave. So we have to do a better job with that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We have a lot of calls to get to, and I'll try to do as many of those as possible. In the January 2014 SiteSelection.com, a recent Brookings Institution report, Rethinking Metropolitan America, looked at what attracted Apple iPhone manufacturer Foxconn to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And the Brookings report concluded that Foxconn came to realize that, and I quote, production sites that can leverage university, government, and private R&D, and a market-ready STEM workforce, and a vibrant cluster of global manufacturing supply chains trump cheap labor and tax breaks. So, first of all, what about that? Is it an either-or proposition? Why don't we start with you, Dale Butland?
I'm sorry, what is the question again?
Whether the market-ready STEM workforce, whether production sites that can leverage university, government, and private R&D in a market-ready STEM workforce and a vibrant cluster of global manufacturing supply chains trump cheap labor and tax breaks.
Yeah, well, there's lots of things that trump cheap labor and tax breaks. You know, we know that from Wharton School studies that have been done of companies as to why you site in certain places mm-hmm. and not others. In terms of the commercialization of university-based research, I know Dr. Vetter has done more work on this perhaps certainly than I have. But as I understand it, Ohio State has never done a very good job with that. We rank last among all the schools in the Big Ten
right.
in terms of the dollars that we generate
the commercialization
from university
of its research.
So Governor Kasich and others have been, in fact, I believe Ohio State is even below OU,
if I'm not mistaken.
I know that getting that up to speed is something that the governor and other leaders around the state have been wanting to do.
Yeah, and Ohio State has been making a big push on that as well. It just wasn't focus for them for too long, whereas a lot of these other colleges have been very aggressive about it. But getting back to your main point, Ann, the workforce is going to trump. Almost every time because these companies, when they are looking around, they have to know that if they go through all of the investment to put these facilities here, that they're actually going to have qualified workers, not just bodies, but actual qualified workers. And, you know, that's something that has been a challenge for Ohio, is proving that they're going to be able to find sufficient workforce.
And these opportunities for R&D and investment and that sort of thing, that this cluster of...
Well, I think the way, you know, the way that they described it in that report, you're talking about clustering around colleges, so you have the high, you know, the highly educated workforce. You're talking about access to technology. I mean, it was a series of factors that all indicate high education levels amongst that local population, and you know, it's no accident that that tends to be clustered around higher education institutions and government, and I think that's probably why you see Columbus doing a little bit better or significantly better than Cleveland and even Cincinnati.
Dr. Vetter, why is it that Ohio State fell to the bottom of the barrel in the Big Ten and commercialization of their research? What were other
well,
universities
should ask
doing?
Gorski that or well, other former executives.
He doesn't take my calls anymore. Yeah.
The university. Well, you know, there's a little bit of a chance element in this.
Right.
For example, Ohio University does have more money coming in from royalties on commercial ventures from inventions than does Ohio State by a long shot. But we have one scientist, he's actually a good friend of mine, who we get, $8 or $10 million a year at the university.
With one cancer drug. That really
from one it. Cancer drug.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
so that there's a little bit of a chance. Science is, you know, a discovery process and scientific research. And sometimes the discovery comes one place and sometimes it comes another. I do think Ohio State has probably been lax, as the others have suggested, in pushing the commercial dimensions of things, and that has changed. If I may just put just a little bit of a cautionary note here, and this isn't to denigrate the importance of R&D or mm-hmm. anything, but there are states in the union that are known as sort of quintessentially high-tech states. California is the best example, Silicon Valley, which if you look at their aggregate economic performance, they'll say the last 10 or 15 years, have been pretty abysmal. California, Native Americans are actually leaving California in large numbers. And they got high-tech up the gazoo. They've got universities like Stanford and Caltech and the University of California, Berkeley and UCLA, that are with all sorts of high-tech innovation. Now, that isn't to say high-tech innovation is irrelevant or negative or anything like that. It is not in and of itself, though, enough. And things like taxes, where California has a 13% marginal tax rate, and no executive in their right mind wants to live in California right now, these things do matter as well. So there are a multiplicity of factors at work here.
Yeah, so if I can just kind of take our discussion a little bit different direction, because without gainsaying the importance of education and a highly trained and skilled workforce for creating jobs, as the economists like to say, that's necessary but not sufficient, because we're talking about long-term jobs here. Many times these education policies and so forth have to take 10 years or longer to start bearing fruit. What happens in the meantime? What we need jobs in our state now, right now. So I think we need to ask ourselves, where do jobs come from? They come from rising consumer demand. Forget all the stuff you're hearing about tax cuts for rich people or tax cuts for small businesses. There's no business on the planet, large or small, that will hire a single additional worker unless the business owner is convinced that his or her customers will buy enough of that company's goods or services to cover the cost of that additional worker. So if we want to create jobs, it seems to me we ought to be pursuing policies that put more money in the pockets of middle and low-income people, because they'll go out and spend it, and they'll buy the washing machines and the televisions and all the other things we need to get our economy back on track. So putting more money in the pockets of the vast majority of people, it seems to me, is critical to getting our economy back.
It sounds like this email from Steve backs up what you're saying, so I'll just read it out. In my opinion, he writes, the only thing that creates jobs will be sales. People need more money to consume more, as Americans tend not to be a savings population. In 1972, a minimum wage hour would buy 4 gallons of gas, 8 loaves of bread. Tax cuts never created a job. Dr. Vetter, thoughts about that?
Well, I guess I just have to flat out disagree on this point. I'm not saying, obviously, people spend money is when people spend more money, sales goes up and so forth. But this is sort of like let's drop money out of airplanes over poor areas, and that somehow we can work our way to prosperity by doing something like that, or that there's some sort of state fiscal policy that we could do that would stimulate the economy and lower unemployment overnight. And frankly, I don't think there is such a policy. And where they have been tried in the past in other jurisdictions and so forth, they've generally not worked particularly well. Running, for example, large budget deficits at the federal level by giving increasing consumption to people in the middle and lower income classes has not dramatically been successful economically, and I think most economists wouldn't say today that this is not all. These sort of demand side policies have limited effectiveness.
Well, but with due respect, Dr. Vetter, when Governor Kasich has pursued his last budget, which was largely budget cuts for schools and local governments, coupled with tax cuts that primarily benefited wealthier people, if I'm not mistaken, you publicly said that you backed that budget and that you thought it would lead to job growth. But here we are, these years later, most of the job growth that has occurred in this administration has occurred in the first 18 months that the governor was in office, before his budget policies or Jobs Ohio were really in effect. So I would suggest that what we're doing now certainly isn't working, and it's not because we're not spending enough money on it. As a matter of fact, Ohio right now is spending more money on economic development than any other country in the any other state in the nation. Back in 2011, our entire development budget was $1.4 billion. Now it is $4 billion. That's $2.3 billion in third frontier money and about another $1.5 billion from Jobs Ohio. That's in addition to the job creation tax credits, the R&D tax credits, the business loan programs, the outright grants, and all the rest. And yet, here we are. Our ranking in job creation is the fourth worst in the nation.
Well, I think I need to respond to that, since it was directed partly to me. I agree with a good bit of what you say, actually. I don't like what I call corporate food stamps, which I'm not the wildest supporter of Jobs Ohio. And I don't like special tax breaks for large corporations as general policy. I find that statistic on a $4 billion program versus $1.3 a little hard to take or understand. But put that aside. And it is, and I will also agree that we've had the last year has not been particularly good on job creation in Ohio. I would agree with that. The policies of reducing taxes to promote economic growth are a long-term strategy. They're not a short-term strategy. They're a strategy that take 2, 3, 4, 5 years to have a dramatic effect. For example, if you're trying to bring new businesses into a community, they don't come the minute you cut taxes. They come maybe 6 months, a year later. It takes a year to build the plan, et cetera. So sometimes it takes, research shows it's a 2-3 year lag between those policies and what actually happens.
If I can just say this, Dr. Vetter, in 2005, there was a 5-year, 21% across the board income tax cut that one party pushed through the legislature from 2005 to 10. We lost 400,000 jobs. It is now 9 years since those tax cuts took effect, which primarily benefited the wealthy. Where are the jobs from that tax
cut?
Those
tax cuts did not take effect, most of them, till 2009-10. They were delayed,
mm-hmm.
and they came in late, and the period from 2000 10, 11, 12 were periods of robust job growth in the state. I think you can argue the evidence either way. So,
Dr. Vetter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, enjoyed it.
Richard Vetter, economist, also from the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. Doug Buchanan of Columbus Business First, thanks for joining us, Doug.
Thank you.
And Dale Butland of Innovation Ohio. Dale, as always, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Ann.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.